So, hi everyone. It's really a great pleasure to welcome you all to this joint event, which is being hosted by the UCL Department of Geography and the London School of Economics International Inequalities Institute. My name is Alka Shah. I'm convener of the Global Economies. Actually, I can hear a lot of background sound. Would you mind if everybody, while we have the speakers, if you could just mute yourselves? Amy, you might be able to mute everybody centrally as well as a host. Yeah, thanks. So those of you who don't know me, I'm Alpa Shah. I'm a convener of the Global Economies of Care research team at the International Inequalities Institute. And I'm also a professor of anthropology at the LSE. Today, we're here to discuss a very important issue, investing in care, and especially the role of private finance in social infrastructures. This is a major issue, as we all know, here in the UK, and of course, in many places internationally too. For although social care has been seen as a drain on the economy, in recent years, care services have also attracted huge investor interest, ranging from all kinds of things, private equity firms to real estate firms, impact investors. So we're really very, very fortunate to have with us two wonderful speakers and a fantastic discussant who will help us address questions about why private finance has come to play such a major role in the care industry, what it means for all those who are working in the care services and relying on them in their day-to-day lives, and who'll also help us think about what alternative approaches we might promote to address some of the inequalities of the current system. So our speakers today are Emma Dowling, who joins us from the University of Vienna, where she teaches and researches the sociology of social change. Prior to moving to Vienna, Emma worked in Germany at the University of Jena, researching the political economy of volunteering. And she also taught sociology at Middlesex University and ethics, governance, and accountability at Queen Mary University of London. Emma has published on lots of topics related to feminism, social reproduction, emotional and affective labor, financialization, and the social economy and the welfare state and its transformation. I mean, these are just a few of the things she's published on. But today she's going to be drawing on her recently published excellent The Care Crisis, which was brought out by Verso in January this year. We also have with us Amy Horton from the UCL Department of Geography, where she teaches economic geography. Amy worked as a policy researcher and campaigner on issues of global justice for a number of years, and then she went on to do her PhD at Queen Mary. She examined how changing ownership of care homes in the UK affects the working conditions and patterns of investment and disinvestment. She's also looked at the strategies that unions take and social movements take to ensure that care is valued more highly, here in the UK and in the US. Now she's part of a team analyzing how the financial impacts of COVID-19 are affecting care home businesses and the workforce in in England. She's also researching housing campaigns and social infrastructure more generally. She is the co-editor of a book, Financing Prosperity by Dealing with Debt. It's going to be published soon by UCL Press. We look forward to that. Emma and Amy are both going to have about 15 minutes each to present their work. And then finally, we're very fortunate to have with us Professor Beverly Skeggs, a distinguished professor of sociology at the University of Lancaster, one of the foremost feminist sociologists in the world, and whose vision was in fact responsible for setting up the Global Economies of Care research theme that I was asked to care for when she went to Lancaster. So, So Bev will discuss the two presentations after Emma and Amy speak, and then we will open up the floor for more general questions. So the idea is we'll finish at 3:30. So there'll be hopefully plenty of time for discussion after Emma, Amy, and Beverly. So over to you now, Emma. Welcome everybody to this event. Thank you.
Sorry, thanks very much for that introduction, Alpha. I'm really delighted to be here and to speak to you about the private finance and care. In the 15 minutes I have, I want to just briefly, because Alpha also mentioned my book, briefly contextualize this discussion in the context of the work that I did on financialization in the book. Outline the sort of theoretical framework of care crisis that I'm working with and say a few words about financialization, as well as the connection between austerity and financialization, as well as then drawing on some of the examples that I studied in the book and passing on to Amy with perhaps some words about the coronavirus crisis and where we are now. So let me just briefly begin by situating what I'm going to talk about in the context of the book, The Care Crisis, that I published this year, that draws on feminist work on care and social reproduction, to ask what does the economy really look like from the perspective of care? And begins from the care deficits that have resulted from the global economic crisis, the global financial crisis, and the takes quite an in-depth look also at the austerity measures and the effects of marketization of care. Really, the point is to say that people haven't stopped caring, even though there's a care crisis, but the conditions under which people are trying to do so are incredibly difficult. But also that care often gets exploited in these conditions precisely because people care. And at the same time, care is so devalued and is affected by intersectional inequalities of gender, ethnicity, class, and so forth. And what I try and do in the book is analyze what I see as a kind of destructive and quite inadequate short-term fixes to an ongoing structural crisis that doesn't really address the problems. And part of that is also financialization. So when I say care crisis, what I mean is people increasingly not having adequate access to care, but also the working conditions, and I would say across the sort of paid and unpaid spectrum, in which people are trying to provide care and do the work of social reproduction are inadequate. We see rising care inequalities both within societies and across them. And overall, it's an exhaustion of societal care resources. And the focus of the book is Britain, but I think we can see that Britain is not the only place that is affected by this. There are a good number of causes that can sort of come together in this crisis. On the one hand, demographic changes like aging, rates of female labor market participation. So on the one hand, rising care needs, but also the sort of traditional gendered arrangement of women in the home being available to do this work has changed, but also a sort of primacy on waged work. And with that, at the same time, a wage stagnation, meaning that more and more work has to be done also to bring in an income, squeezing also the time available for care and social reproduction, austerity and privatization, and at the same time, a kind of politics of personal responsibility that has become quite key. And here, also, I think one of the driving forces is the ways in which both globalization and with that financialization have undermined the kind of reproductive deal that existed prior to that. So this sort of reproductive deal of Fordism, Keynesianism. And I want to spend just a couple of moments explaining what I mean by that. What I mean by that is, on the one hand, so the ways in which with globalization, there's this certainly in global north countries, a kind of flight from labor, the reliance on the reproduction of labor power elsewhere, but also the sort of ways in which capital flees into finance and the kinds of financial deregulations that happen as a result. And the ways in which there is a kind of delinking of the relationship between work and subsistence. So here I'm also drawing on the work of Dick Bryan and Mike Rafferty, who also argue that the idea that the wage is supposed to provide some basic standard of living for families is ruptured. It becomes kind of delinked. And so casualization, precariousness, welfare state retrenchment, these sorts of things happen in its wake. But of course, and I do want to emphasize that while this is also happening, this reproductive deal of that kind of Fordist Keynesian era was of course also upheld by the unpaid reproductive and care work in the home. So I think also when we bring in the perspective of care, we also, and of social reproduction, we're not only looking at this sort of wage relations, but also the broader context in which financialization also plays a role. And because we're talking today about private finance and care, I wanted to just spend a few moments speaking about what we mean, or what I consider we should mean by financialization. And when we use the term, what is it exactly? And a sort of general definition, which is the definition also put forward by Epstein, is that we're seeing an increasing role of financial motives, markets, actors, and institutions. But also, as Bryan and Rafferty have stressed, the calculus of finance comes to dominate more and more areas of social life and also subjectivity. Michel Fayet wrote an essay in 2009 where he draws attention to the ways in which we become kind of investee selves. Our subjectivities are orientated around the ways in which finance works. And of course, this is not just something that is about the way that people understand themselves, but the material conditions change, making finance more important also in people's lives, particularly there where welfare is transformed towards sort of individualized understandings, asset-based at the level of households, but also outcomes-based at the level of the state. And I'll say a little bit more about that later. But when we say the calculus of finance, what is it exactly that we mean? Well, we mean the ways in which quantification, measurement, and the pricing or evaluation of performance become key, but also the pricing of probabilities. I think this is an important aspect too. Bryan and Rafferty have spent a lot of time thinking about the ways in which risk is shifted to individuals and to households, so also the way that financial engineering can operate to often privatize gains, but socialize the risks, particularly with regard to an exposure to volatility in the case of economic downturns. So things might be okay when everything's going fine, but if we have an economic downturn or also a financial crisis, then the risks of that are offloaded onto the shoulders of individuals and households. In the book, I spend quite a bit of time looking at the ways in which austerity and financialization are connected. So I look not only at the ways in which austerity takes effect in terms of cuts to public services and also particularly council funding, which is also why there was such a considerable knock-on with regard to social care. But also I was interested in the ways in which sort of how both the business models of certain types of private finance, types of public-private partnership come under pressure, as well as how new opportunities for finance are also generated. So business models come under pressure in terms of the ways in which at local council level, we've got to care homes or home care, local authorities and paying care providers below sustainable rates, providers, particularly in home care, find themselves handing back contracts, but also with regard to care homes, charging self-funders fees that subsidise council-funded residents, and ways in which the business model, which often relies, I think Amy's going to talk more about this, on quite high rates of return for, particularly with regard to care homes, comes under pressure because those high rates of profits can't be generated also there where, for example, interest payments still have to be made. So these business models come under pressure, but also where cuts hit, new opportunities emerge, both for the provision of care, but also for the prevention of care. And if you're not quite clear on what I might mean by that, what I'm concerned about is on the one hand, the ways in which private finance enters the areas like care homes and home care, or also foster care, to provide care, but also the kinds of new public-private partnerships that have been developed with regard to things like social impact bonds that I'm going to talk about in a moment, that are actually geared more towards saving the costs of welfare. And in the book, I talk about this as a way in which actually those who have been abandoned, particularly by austerity, also become sort of bankable. And so the examples that I look at in the book are fourfold. I mention foster care, and I want to say a little bit about that now. I also look at platforms and assistive technologies that I'm not going to talk about now because of the lack of time. Home care and care homes are something that Amy is going to speak about, particularly care homes. But I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about impact investing and social impact bonds, because that's an area that I've spent quite a lot of time looking at. And I think there is also something qualitatively new as well about the way that financialization works here. So one example of corporatized foster care is one where I would argue that fits sort of the idea of providing care. There has been an increased entry of private equity into this area, and also there has been an increase in the numbers of children placed in care. And I found this quote from the Financial Times quite revealing here in making this link between austerity and financialization. It says that as benefit cuts pile the pressure on struggling families, private equity and other companies have been attracted to the sector, largely because they can see the potential for cost savings and economies of scale, particularly in administration and training through consolidation and by increasing the volume of cases on their books. And I think here already there is a sort of implication of how this impacts those who provide and need care. One of the ways is, of course, the intention of creating economies of scale, but also offering the potential for cost savings. I think one of the things that we have to ask here is to what end are these cost savings being made, when these are cost savings to the public purse, perhaps, that are then in turn being actually privatized. And here I think the example of social impact bonds is very revealing. Now, for those of you who might have never heard of social impact bonds before, what they are is a type of private finance that can be used for, by governments or local councils that are intent on solving a particular social problem that they might have by using private finance that is then pays for a particular project that then promises to generate certain outcomes and also provide a return on investment. And looking at the ways in which in the last 10 years this has been trialed in the UK, we see that actually the focus is on the most disadvantaged in society, in the most deprived areas of the country, as part of a sort of discourse of helping people, solving social problems and improving the situation. But at the same time, we could also see that actually these are often the same populations that have been particularly affected by austerity. So, for example, some of the projects are preventing social isolation among elderly people, preventing long-term chronic illness, preventing homelessness or for young people from becoming NEETs, also preventing children being taken into care, end-of-life care, mental health. These are sort of areas that I would say pertain also to a kind of care crisis where these bonds are being trialed. And I think what is particularly interesting about the way that they work, and also particularly worrying about the way that they work, is they sort of promise cost savings for the public purse, because these are all costs and these people are costs to the welfare state. And the promise is that future cashable savings can be determined, can be quantified and measured, and then also form part of the return on investment. So the question is where the savings actually are for the public purse, if they in turn are the incentives for investment. Now, you could argue that actually, why would it be a bad idea to engage in these sorts of projects? On the surface, this seems like a good idea. But there is a sort of obfuscation of the actual structural causes of these issues and the inequalities that they rest on, and very much just a focus on shaping individual conduct. So the Life Chances Fund talks about helping people to lead happy and productive lives. And also so that they are less of a cost burden. So this sort of shaping of individual conduct, also the ways that outcomes are then, the metrics of outcomes have to be determined and priced, are orientated towards making this system of returns on investment work. And I would argue also that prevention suits financialization because it allows for the costing of risk and the rendering profitable of speculative futures. So the idea of future cashable savings here. Now, these are in many ways being trialed, and often the investors are philanthropic investors. But the question is also, if these are supposed to actually function like financial markets, what will happen longer term and how might these be instituted more generally, and would SIBs perhaps also be tradable at some point?
We're quite over time. Maybe
I was just coming to an end now. I thought I was finishing at 3:25.
Go ahead, do finish off, and then we can discuss maybe some of what is to be done questions in the discussion as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I just wanted to make the point that I think that with regard to the logic that is being instituted by this is, like in the book I talk about a kind of financialized Victorianism. So the idea that actually private, that the decision about what constitutes a social problem is privatized, and also that the funds for this are provided by private individuals. And so we see a sort of regressive moment again in terms of the ways in which charity and as opposed to public infrastructure is emphasized. And just to end then, I think that obviously in the context of the coronavirus crisis, we've seen that we have a problem, and that social care infrastructures require more resources and also a fundamental reform. And I think the situation in care homes has really brought this to a head. And so with that, I will pass on to Amy, because I know that she has something to say about that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, over to you, Amy.
Okay, hopefully you can see my slides now. Is that a nod, Alpa? Yes, yeah, great, thank you. So thanks so much, Alper, for your introduction. And Emma, I really enjoyed your presentation. And looking at the list of participants, I can see we have a wealth of expertise on the call. So thank you all for joining. And I'm really looking forward to your questions and comments after we've spoken. So I'm going to talk now about the policies and business strategies. That have drawn private investment into care homes. And I think we can think about care homes as a form of social infrastructure in several senses. So there's the built environment, labouring bodies, and also relations of care. When care homes are shaped around the needs of investors, these infrastructures get reworked in ways that require additional labour from care workers and residents of care homes. And I'll explain kind of how that happens. And finally, talk a bit about some alternative approaches to investing in care as a social infrastructure that could contribute to better support services and the valuing of care. So first, a quick word about my empirical focus, which is care homes for people aged over 65 in England. So care homes are a major element of welfare provision. They provide support with daily living and in some cases nursing care to more than 400,000 people. And they're also a very large employer. So if we include other types of care and support outside care homes, social care accounts for about 6% of jobs in the UK. And that's despite a very high vacancy rate in the sector, which itself reflects that pay for care workers is barely above the minimum wage. I'm sure many of you know more than 4 in 5 care workers are women and 21% are Black, Asian and minority ethnic. Social care in England has always been means tested, and so it's funded by a mix of individual payments and local authority funds primarily. So that combination of fragmentation and the devaluing of care work and care workers as low status have made privatisation easier to achieve in this sector than in some others. Going back to the late 1970s, public capital funding was cut back and policies promoted marketisation. So private companies gradually displaced the state and voluntary organisations as the main developers and operators of care homes. And by 2010, only 8% of residential home places were in the public sector. So reliance on private finance for care homes is certainly not just a product of the last decade of austerity, although austerity has intensified that reliance. So certain high-risk forms of finance have come to dominate among the largest care chains. By 2011, chains owned by investment funds were responsible for about 1 in 5 care home residents, and by 2015 they owned 7 of the top 10 companies. Private equity funds have been especially significant. They started buying out care companies in the 1990s and then expanded their market share significantly in the 2000s. So I think that represented a shift from privatization to financialization, signifying the introduction of different sources of financing and riskier business practices. So key practices of investment funds include selling off care companies' property assets, borrowing on capital markets rather than from banks, and loading care companies with much higher levels of debt. So research by the Centre for Health and Public Interest, who are a partner of mine on a current research project, found that among the largest 18 private care home companies, 15% of revenues get devoted to profit, rent, director remuneration and interest. That's more than double the proportion within small and medium-sized care companies. So I think these forms of extraction reflect a kind of broader rentierization of economies. They're structuring around the control of and generation of income or rents from scarce assets, as Brett Christophers has written, and Kendra Strauss has also written about kind of rentierization in the care sector in Canada and elsewhere. So for care companies, this has been unsustainable. So if we look at the example of Four Seasons, which is one of the largest care chains, in 2006, the company was bought by investors for £1.4 billion. almost all of that funding was debt. And that price was nearly double what the company had been sold for 2 years earlier, 14 times the company's earnings. So we had this kind of bubble building up. And in 2009, Four Seasons required an £800 million debt restructuring. So that was huge, even in the kind of context of the financial crisis. But despite the crisis, debt restructuring, new ownership, we saw this overhang of debt. And by 2016, Four Seasons had 13% of the debts across the residential care sector, and only 5% of the beds as the unit goes. So in 2019, the company collapsed into administration. So we've seen these kind of booms and busts and crises, and investor strategies have shifted over time. Initially, profits could be made from cutting costs, including on staffing levels and pay. And many companies also banked on a growing market of publicly funded residents as population aging continued. But austerity undermined that kind of model. So as those early strategies reached their limits, the concept of social infrastructure, I think, can help us to understand another dimension of interest from private investors. In investor discourse, social sciences, and public policy, social infrastructure often refers to aspects of the built environment that connect people or provide physical spaces for service provision, as Strauss and Xu have written. And this perspective, I think, can be useful in thinking about care homes, because the built environment has been at the heart of so much investor interest in the sector. A lot of analysis of care has emphasized the production of the workforce and working conditions without paying much attention to the spaces of care. But care homes' property assets have come to occupy an increasingly significant role in investor strategies. So amid kind of high demand for real estate, investors could quickly recoup funds that they'd used to buy care companies by selling off the property assets and moving them onto a rental model. One investor I spoke to described the sale and leaseback model as phenomenally accretive for buyout firms, but obviously not for everyone. So sale and leaseback played a role in the collapse of the major care chain Southern Cross in 2011, as the company struggled to meet its rental bill. So we have seen some scrutiny of private equity in care, but there's been a lot less attention to the role of care home landlords, including real estate investment trusts. The REITs have in recent years emerged as a major landlord, developer, and lender in the sector. And a rough estimate is that they're responsible for perhaps 30,000 care home residents. So REITs effectively allow investors to buy tradable shares in property, paying dividends based on rental income and offering share price gains where real estate values rise. And they've been part of a group of actors promoting care homes as a kind of alternative property investment that can help to diversify portfolios alongside other alternatives such as student housing and hotels. And indeed, care homes have increasingly been modelled on hotels. That helps to make them intelligible and calculable to investors, and holds out the promise of an easy change of use if demand for residential care falls. It also fits with an emphasis on charging premium hotel costs for bed, board, and services, which are separate from the costs of care itself. And these hotel costs underpin relatively high rents paid by the operators on these REIT-owned homes. So in order to pay hotel costs, residents are expected to draw on their personal savings, pensions, and property wealth. And so geographical inequalities in the distribution of wealth are leading to more uneven landscapes of care. In richer regions, we see high-cost homes being built. Elsewhere, capital to upgrade homes is scarce. So people without the ability to pay high fees can be excluded in either type of region, or in some cases they might be admitted to a home but even evicted when their funds run out. However, the issues aren't just of privatised costs and unequal access to care, which might suggest that social care does actually work for the wealthiest, if no one else. But rather, in interviews, care staff have spoken about how hotel-style facilities are less homely. Multiple identical large wings can be disorienting to residents with dementia. In these big kind of economies of scale offering homes, that might work for investors, but for the people who live there, it can be harder to get to know each other and form relationships. And there's a greater emphasis on the individual room that can divert attention from kind of interaction. So for these reasons and others, the kind of upshot is that residents and staff have to work harder to make that space work for them and create a sense of home and effective care. So what's happened is a transfer of the labour that's required to make a place-based care home into a tradable liquid asset. Standardised hotel-style care homes are easier for investors to deal with, they're easier to price, they're easier to categorise and exchange, but these imperatives produce standardised spaces that require more labour from residents and staff to fulfil their needs. So this brings us to another dimension of social infrastructure, which feminist scholars, including Emma, have highlighted in contrast to those approaches that focus on social infrastructure solely as places that provide a kind of physical platform for relationships or whatever, or as Sarah Marie Hall has called it, kind of community building in community buildings. So this critique reminds us that social infrastructure always depends on labour. And sometimes the need for labour increases where investment is lacking. For example, people taking on more unpaid care to fill gaps in provision. But the quality of investment also matters as much as the quantity, or in other words, who has power over resources. So we've seen lots of private investment going into care homes, but that serves to intensify pressures on care workers as corporate revenues are diverted to paying higher rents, debts, and returns to investors. Buyouts have led to significant reductions in terms and conditions for care staff, including entitlements to sick pay in ways that have had kind of terrible ramifications over the last year and a half. And residents have also been affected by greater rationing of basic equipment, such as commodes. So here we can learn from the case for investment in social infrastructure that's been made by some feminist economists and policy advocates, with calls for greater public spending on both social sites and services in order to promote well-being, long-term fiscal savings, wider sustainable economic activity, and decent work. So as people have pointed out, such as the Women's Budget Group, care work is essential work and low carbon and can be part of a caring Green New Deal or a feminist Green New Deal. So how might we work towards this more caring, just and sustainable approach? There's a number of kind of alternative practices that have been adopted or advocated by local authorities and devolved administrations. I think there's kind of perhaps three key areas of practice and recommendations. So first, taking care homes into public ownership, which has been advocated by unions such as GMB, where homes are being sold off by private providers. But, you know, how do we prevent that going back to the sort of failures of the past? Second, restricting or more heavily regulating the finances and business practices of care homes. So that could involve using licensing or commissioning practices to set limits on debt levels or block companies' use of tax havens. And third, supporting alternative forms of financing and ownership, be that public capital funding or cooperative models, for example. But of course, all of this in England is significantly constrained by central government policy. And that, more or less, it looks like continues to hinge on the conflicting concerns of cost to the public purse and preservation of private property and inheritance. And Boris Johnson, in his first speech as Prime Minister almost 2 years ago, said, "My job is to protect you or your parents or grandparents from the fear of having to sell your home to pay for the costs of care." So that's the kind of organising principle of a lot of care policy. And vested interests in the status quo are, of course, another impediment to change. In fact, new legislative proposals would allow for direct public bailouts of for-profit homes for the first time. And a further barrier to change is the widespread aversion to confronting the possibility of needing care and support in our later lives, as feminist scholars such as Nancy Fraser and Joan Tronto have written. So many of us only engage with social care when crises or impairments are too severe for us to have much capacity for advocacy and organising. But perhaps there are glimmers of hope in growing public attention to care, the greater bargaining power of workers if staff shortages really bite deeper amid COVID recovery, and wider adoption of critiques of financialisation. Actually, the Daily Mail currently has a campaign against equity vultures in care homes. So the pandemic has shaken care companies with much higher costs and lower rates of occupancy, and demands on the physical and relational social infrastructures have been unprecedented. This is a moment for us to kind of reorient the future of care, I think. And in considering that, we need to, of course, to be mindful of the potential for care to be paternalistic and oppressive. Disabled people's organisations and scholars such as Jenny Morris have called instead for support for independent living. And it is vital to secure and uphold legal rights as the basis for people having choice and control over our own lives, being included in the community and having the same chances to take part as other people, to quote the Reclaiming Our Futures Alliance. But I don't think that's incompatible with the kind of politics of interdependence advocated by the Care Collective, authors of the Care Manifesto, among others. That's a call for a relational ethics of care that we can adopt across different spheres of life beyond familial or national boundaries, inspired by a range of feminist, indigenous and queer theorists and movements. So I'll leave it there and look forward to hearing from others. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Amy and Emma. Emma, both for the kind of wide-ranging vision that you provided us, and then focusing on the financialization, and what we've had with Amy's presentation is brilliant to lay open out so many issues, which I think Bev is going to take up now in her discussion. So over to you, Bev, and then we will open up the floor for a more general discussion too.
Okay, well, thank you so much, both. I mean, incredible range of very provocative issues and such a complex situation to understand. I think you're drawing the big pictures, but even thinking about how those work in practice is just so incredibly difficult. And so the more we have on this and the more detail we have, the better. I just want to draw on kind of three different areas that I'll throw to you first, and then hopefully to the audience as well. I think the first one is, you're both talking about the significance of debt. I mean, Emma, personal debt in a sense, and Amy, debt write-offs. I mean, 800 million to write-offs, quite significant. And I do see that in Emma, in your description, and I think it's such an important point where you talk about the delinking of work and subsistence, because how do people survive without debt? And we've seen this increase so massively. And then the other thing that happened to me when I was trying to find care provision for my mother in an area where there wasn't any at all, because private equity investors didn't want to invest in that area, was that I had to find somewhere and go into debt to be able to afford the care provision itself. So debt becomes an actual mechanism in so many ways. And I wondered if you both saw the connections, but also the real differences between the different types of debt. So I want to kind of throw that one out first, but there's a lot in there and I'm sure you can tell us more. The other thing is the role of the state, which continually baffles me, especially during the COVID crisis. I think it baffles everybody. But I remember the really great work by, Bob Jessop and Martin Jones and Jamie Peck on crisis metamorphoses, that the state never really deals with anything since the 1980s, because it just keeps creating new bodies that have no expertise and transferring that crisis on continually. And I think we see this writ large with the care sector, in every element of the care sector. And I think you've both described that brilliantly in the way you outlined different areas, because, you know, we could obviously, the easiest example, the most popular example is Dido Harding track and trace, and then possibly becoming, you know, head of the NHS. So it's just crisis metamorphoses, no expertise, can't do the job, just move around and create a new body, get rid of anything that could be semi-efficient, like Public Health England, for instance. So we see that in care analysis all the time. So partly the role of the state is always in crises, metamorphoses. So I suspect we're never going to get any significant response from the state. We've had a green paper on care since 2017, the Daily Mail threatening to, you know, voters will withdraw, and nothing happens. Really, really nothing happens. And then I think what we see, Emma, with your social investment bonds and Dan Nayland's empirical analysis of investment bonds in childcare, is they get paid 10%, but then they pull out. So it's a bit like private equity operating through the state. We also see, as you pointed out, Amy, the state is an ATM machine, because the state does have regulations. So I also want to kind of throw up that relationship between private equity and regulation, because historically regulation was the limit to private equity companies. It would put, you know, it would kind of make them less comfortable, but it seems to have no effect anymore. It seems to actually enable them to use the state to actually support the crisis that has occurred if they flip all their assets and pull out. And then I think thirdly, and I'll just throw this out and then over to you two and then back to the audience, is I do wonder how we deal this at different levels. So I have no faith in the national state. I have some faith in the local state, but the policies really limit the local state. And then I wonder what happens. There was a case in the Northwest where, through fantastic union organisation, to give care workers more than £3 an hour, which is effectively what they were receiving for the time they put in, the campaign increased the wages and it was very, very successful. But what happened was it was against Bupa, a Bupa care home, and Bupa just pulled out. And what you end up with is the seven care holes, the complete lack of care in Britain. So there is no provision. And when you're facing that, as I had to face that, trying to find care, when there is no provision, what do you do? And I do agree with the Care Manifesto. I love it. And I do love with both of your conclusions, you know, the Green New Deal, the Women's Budget Group, absolutely brilliant proposals, but who will take them on? But also municipalism, as you write about, Emma, can we make that work? And how caring is interdependence. And part of me, there is part of me, there's the old part of me, well, all of me is the old part, but there is part of me that just feels like, what would we do if we had a care strike? You know, like the Wages for Housework campaign or the sex strike campaign. What would happen if there was a care? I know there can't be, because we can't, you know, disregard our children and our elderly, you know, all our responsibilities. But politically, you know, that political polemic that was, you know, Federici and Selma James put out with Wages for Housework. What would happen if we stopped providing care? Would anybody notice? And what would be the consequences of that? So I'll just throw those bits out and then we'll open out into the audience. But thank you both. It's a great book, Emma. Amy, I just love reading your work as well as listening to you. I always learn so much every time. And I think extending it into space is so important. So thank you both so much. And thank you, ALPA, for putting this on and organising it with Amy. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Bev. Sorry, there's such such important comments that you've opened up with. I think it's only fair to go back to Emma and Amy immediately to address some of these, whatever you want, of these big issues that Beth has laid out. And then maybe we can have a more general discussion. And if anybody wants to, we can maybe, because we could probably have a conversation, so you can just open your mic and speak. I'll invite you if you raise your hand. And if you feel more comfortable putting your comments in the chat, then please do that as well. Okay, so Amy?
Thanks, Alpha, and thank you so much for those comments, Bev. I think you're absolutely right to think about these as those as kind of critical axes shaping care. I don't want to talk for too long because I want to give other people an opportunity to speak. I think there's clear connections between the different, between debt across different scales. So although this has changed to some extent over the last year, you know, the government in the UK over the last decade has been very determined to reduce many kinds of public debt and has been happy to strike this bargain with privatized care companies that they will take on private debt. But of course, the way in which that is organized tends to be, you know, in the interests of the actors that are most powerful within those companies, and that is not the care workers. So we see that kind of corporate debt burden expanding in a way that gets translated or transferred onto the staff. And I'm, you know, I think there's a lot more to be said also about sort of household debt connected to care work. So there's been great scholarship on unpaid care and the kind of financial and other forms of strain that that can put on households. But that dynamic of kind of debt among paid care staff is something that I want to explore further in research that we're doing at the moment. In terms of the role of the state, I mean, you're absolutely right about crisis metamorphosis. I think that those ideas are very useful to think about what's been happening, and that we've had this model of kind of seeking to promote greater market choice and consumer rights within care, rather than sort of effective regulation, really. On how do we change things? So some of my research has looked at sort of efforts to change the narrative around care in the US by presenting stories of the kind of joys and relationships of care and how they can be put under strain by some of these issues. And I think that organizing in the US can be an inspiration to us here, because there are different set of policy proposals on the table there. Whether anything gets enacted, we will have to see. But yeah, the care strike, maybe we need some other way of visibilizing these activities that can't be halted and that often take place behind closed doors. I was wondering about doing a research project where we get people to kind of, I don't know, use smart watches to track their unpaid care, whether that's workers doing overtime or people doing unpaid care in their own homes. So I haven't thought that through, but perhaps that's different strategies to try and make some visible. So I'll stop there and hand over to Emma for a comment, and then we can open up to the floor.
Thanks, Amy. I also won't take too long. Thank you, Bev, for your comments. Very briefly on the issue of debt, because you asked whether there are different types of debt, or how do we think the sort of private debt in terms of the way that, that private equity, for example, leverages debt. And then also the situation with regard to household debt. And I think it's really important to hold at the forefront of our mind that there are precisely these power relations with regard to debt, and the ways in which actually financial engineering can be used to deal with that debt. Whereas actually the debt that households have, they can't just sort of engineer that away. So I think like really a class analysis of debt shows us that these differences, that debt is not the same, whether we look at it from the perspective of capital or the perspective of labor. On the states, just to say there about the apropos of the state as an ATM machine, with regard to social impact bonds, of course, the state puts in has put in a lot of money to try and make it work, also offering top-up funds to pay the return on investment if no returns on investment can be generated. So you see here also changes in legislation that have occurred in order to allow for the Public Value, Social Value Act, Public Services and Social Value Act, for example. So the question of how we deal with this is, of course, directly related to the issue of the state, and we can't just wave a wand and get the state to do things. But I do think that the local level, the municipal level, does offer potential. It is more immediate. Also, there is potential there for organizing in terms of thinking about how care might be different across paid and unpaid work. And here, I think it's also a question of, on the one hand, supporting the struggles of care workers, also when they do go on strike, but also thinking how we get together across the ways in which perhaps the current system pits us against one another. So care recipients versus care workers versus, so how do we think about in what ways are we all on the same side, and how do we care for ourselves and one another on our own terms? So I think the missing link is also that we need a different way of doing social reproduction, right? We also need to work less in paid work in order to have more time to care for one another and build the kinds of care infrastructure we need, as well as more resources for professional care.
If I can use my chair's prerogative to just ask a question immediately following that, which has been kind of burning as you've been speaking. What you said about we really need to actually rethink, you know, how we do social reproduction. And I wondered if you had, either of you had come across any inspiring models of care provision within communities, of, you know, rethinking the very notion of the nuclear family, which, you know, family rearrangements or more communal ways of living, and how, where do you see these inspiring models of how, you know, rethinking social reproduction? I mean, where should we be looking to? What have you come across, both of you? And then I'll hand over to Christine Collette Walker for her question.
Just very, very briefly, thanks, Alpha. I think on the one hand, I do think the kind of communalization, remunicipalization movements have been doing really interesting stuff here also. For example, in Spain, like Barcelona in Comú, I think there's some interesting things happening there. I do think also that it is a question of trying to think about new models, but not in a way that sort of is just like plugging gaps, but actually also with a kind of antagonistic understanding of where we're also clawing back resources and demanding more resources. So I think that for me, the remunicipalization movements are quite interesting to look at in this regard.
Absolutely. I mean, the sort of Butzorg model in the Netherlands is often referenced as something which is much more kind of self-managed and nurse-led, and, you know, people live in small groups, and it's just a much more kind of humane scale to operate in. It's not an area that I know tons about, but there are some great reports on that approach. But I think we need to sort of take a step back and think about you know, which elements of care do we want to be done by skilled professionals? And of course, care work also involves kind of, you know, having time to get to know someone and have a chat or whatever, if that's what both people want to do. And then how do we also sort of make more time and space for unpaid care, which can happen beyond the family and within communities, to make care kind of genuinely social. So I think we've got to sort of, strip it back a bit and think about the different kind of contributions that can be made by different actors. But when it comes to something like dementia care, you know, that there is a need for kind of specialist skills and resources. So as kind of inspiring some of the mutual aid activity and stuff that lots of us have been involved in the last year has been, I think we can't kind of go that way entirely. But Alpo, perhaps you have a suggestion. Have you, come across things?
Yeah, they have their own problems, right? But yeah, we can talk more another time, I'm sure, Amy. Let me hand over to Christine Colette Walker, who's had her hand up for some time now to ask her question. And then after that, Susan Himmelwaite.
I actually think I saw a question chat before we jump in. And had questions. I don't want to leap in ahead of her if she wants to ask it.
Sorry, Christine, I couldn't hear you.
I think somebody put a question in the chat, hand up, so I'd like leap ahead of the
queue. All right, you go ahead and then I'll look at the questions in the chat.
Okay,
too.
All right, fab. So it might be just about. So often I think the issue of debt is framed, you know, from the private sector perspective in quite a positive way, as a way of, you know, these companies need private capital and they need to take on debt and invest in services. And obviously we would, you know, the way that you speak about it, I conceptualize it in our working paper this year, is that kind of cost shifting framework. So as so instead of being debt being taken on to the benefit of the residents and workers, in fact, it's to increase the return to investment to these investors, and that comes at the price of working conditions, quality of care. But any of you are aware of any kind of concrete, either qualitative or quantitative evidence of that cost shifting? And so in the you know, a debt leverage buyout has happened, that we do in fact see a kind of squeeze on wages and quality of care, or if it is still at this point kind of just a sort of theoretical argument shifting, because that's often where I come up against a barrier, as people will, like, do you have concrete evidence to this is happening? I've been coming up a bit short on that front.
Thanks. I'll take Susan's question as well. Susan?
Hi. Well, thank you both very much. I really, really enjoyed all three of your presentations. I have a question for Amy that's got some, and then I want to ask Emma something that's related. You talked about when budget groups talking about social infrastructure, but what we tend to mean by social infrastructure is not just the buildings in which the care goes on, but the whole caboodle, you know, and part of what we also say is, you know, that the work of care workers is part of that infrastructure. And I was interested that you used a different term. And I was interested in why, but also, and your use is, I mean, there are other people who use social infrastructure in the way that you do too, that, you know, if you read the European Commission on its report on social infrastructure, it would have used it to mean the physical infrastructure involved in social type things. But what that made me think about was whether that whole issue of financialization depends on there being physical infrastructure. I mean, are we getting financialization, for example, of domiciliary care, or is it only residential care? Is it always based on the existence of physical property?
Yeah, Amy, do you want to come back?
Yeah, thank you all for your questions. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit echo. So Sue, sorry, my presentation must have been unclear, because I was trying to say social infrastructure encompasses both the kind of physical infrastructure and the labour of care. So apologies if I didn't convey that clearly enough. And I think, of course, the labour is absolutely critical to it. And perhaps picking up also on the point that Dahlia's raised in the chat about kind of platformization of care provision. So I think we're seeing that more and more in the case of home care, with the kind of gig economy model and a sort of Tinder for home care basically approach, where you swipe through the different possible workers that you could employ. And so I think that we are seeing financialization there. In the case of the kind of more traditional home care agencies, there was a lot of investment, but I think that started to fall apart even earlier than in the care home sector because of the pressures of austerity and the lack of those property assets to liquidate. So there's some distinctions there, but we're seeing kind of new strategies emerge and take hold. Chrissy, thank you for your report. I mean, which I would recommend thank you for your question and for your report, which I'd recommend to everyone. I mean, in my work, I've got some kind of reports of individual cases of, care homes in the east of England being outsourced from the public sector to a private equity provider, a complete change of the model of ownership and cuts to the terms and conditions of staff. So they were basically offered, you stay in your job, but we're remaking the role and your pay is going down significantly alongside that. And then the Centre for Health and the Public Interest report that I mentioned has some great analysis of, where the money is going, but it does have some stuff on kind of staffing costs and so on. So I'd recommend that to you. I didn't actually get onto the references page of my slides, I remember, but I'm happy to share that with anyone who'd like to see them. So I'll stop there. I can see there's some more questions in the chat, but I'll try and have a read and hand over to Emma.
Thanks. I just wanted to come back. Hi, Susan. Really great to see you. I think the point about care homes is important. The real estate really does matter. But also when I was doing research for the book, there is also a private investment in home care. As Amy said, it's much more difficult. And I think one of the issues is it really is difficult to create economies of scale. I mean, as you point out in your work, Susan, the sort of profitability, there isn't really any profitability. So it does become difficult. And I just wonder how, though, there is the ways in which perhaps the new platform economy is a way here also, another way for financialization to occur in these new kinds of platformized services. So perhaps there's a link there that we need to look at. I mean, Amy already stressed that. Also, in terms of evidence, I wonder whether, I think Amy's work is important here, but also the European Services Strategy Units, and perhaps there, I think there are people in the audience maybe who could say a little bit more there too, because I know that is for me also a really important resource in terms of these practices.
Thanks. Lizzie Ward, you've got your hand raised. Would you like to unmute yourself? Thanks.
Hi, thanks very much. Brilliant, really, really interesting presentations. And I come from more the kind of practice of care. So this is all mind-boggling for me, thinking about the nature of care itself and how you make it sort of follows that how you make a profit at care from the nature of care, because a lot of care is, takes a lot of time, involves being, as you mentioned, Amy. So great stuff. But my question, I guess, was around sort of the local state and the possibilities of, local states doing anything. And I wonder if you'd thought about the implementation of the Care Act in 2014, which I think really coincided with the worst impacts of austerity, when it was really beginning to sort of bite in terms of people just not getting care services or even social care assessments with social workers, that kind of thing. And this really, puzzling thing that this term of market shaping, which was given as a legal duty to local responsibilities, and what part that plays in all of the things that you've talked about in terms of the financialization and all these strategies of private finance coming into sort of care services. Thank you.
Do you want to address that question? There's also a couple of questions in chat about one about automation and its significance in terms of debt and financialization in care homes.
Yeah, who should go? I don't mind who goes first. I think thanks for the point about the Care Act, because I think there's the sort of market shaping issue is really important. Also, the Care Act of 2014 also stresses the social investment stuff as well. But of course, these are processes that were going on beforehand already, where local councils were supposed to be shaping and these markets. And I guess for me, it's a reminder also that we have to tackle these issues of regulation and legislation as well, and show the ways in which these processes are inscribed in law and challenging those. Easier said than done, but I think it's a really important aspect, particularly also around sort of regulation stuff, because it is also if we have a situation where the government says we'll give more money, but if that just goes into sort of sustaining profits, then what's the point of that? So we could have a very populist moment there that actually would not achieve the ends that we need. On automation, I think here also there the ways in which technology at present a lot of the time is used either to surveil workers or speed up work. I think those are really very, very serious issues, or the ways that assistive technologies are sort of geared towards enabling people to take care of themselves, and so that everybody else can go off and do something else or be available for the labour market or whatever it is. I think these looking at these technologies very closely, I think is important, while at the same time also not recognizing that actually the technology could also be help us to care better, and how do we make a difference between the two. And I just wanted to pick up on the point in the chat also about care work, and here's some about FE colleges and care homes recruiting young at low pay. And I do think here also we need to be wary of a sort of recruitment drive that tries to bring in also various previously excluded or marginalized populations into the care sector as a way of also solving the problem, and sort of being aware of that. I mean, certainly also in Germany there has also been a kind of discourse of people with refugee backgrounds, that this is sort of an area for them, which in principle it could well be, but when you link these two aspects together, then it becomes obviously also problematic. So I think it's still about care expertise, qualification, training, and more resources and better pay.
Thanks, Amy.
Yes, I'd agree. And I mean, of course, when we think about kind of training care workers, we've got to pay homage to Deb's fantastic work on that in the past. And I think apprentice schemes have been a huge feeder of care workers in care homes in recent years. It's dropped off a bit more recently, but they were talking about people who aren't entitled to minimum wage and so on, and who tend to leave the care sector very quickly. So it's unsurprising that kind of model of labour supply is not successful for anyone concerned, really. And on the question about automation, I mean, I'd recommend some of the work that's going on by scholars in the Sheffield Centre for, it's CIRCLE is the acronym. So I think, as Emma kind of alluded to, some of this technology is kind of geared towards keeping people out of care homes, which may be a very good thing. But if it's sort of making people use wearable tech so that if they have a fall, they can be eventually scooped up by someone who otherwise, wouldn't be checking on them or supporting them in ways that they might need, then that's, of course, a concern. And Lizzie's question about market shaping, I think, we've had this kind of phantom approach to regulating care, where local authorities, which have been really stripped to the bone in many cases, have been supposed to be responsible for doing the kind of market research and creating a mixed economy of providers in their local area. And of course, many of them don't have the capacity to do that. So now there's plans to put in place sort of greater oversight by the Department of Health and Social Care of what local authorities are doing, but without greater resources or making sure that those resources reach the right people and places in the care system. It's a sort of hopeless task. I see there's some more questions coming into the chat now, so I'll pause there.
Oh yes, an observation from Kendra Strauss about what's happening in China, where women who are aged out of factory work are being targeted by the local state for care work jobs. I actually wanted to ask Emma, you've been working in, you've been working as in not necessarily researching, but living in Germany and in Vienna now. And I mean, what can we learn from what's happening there that's different or that could be thought about in relation to what could be done back here in the UK? It'd be really interesting to hear from you on that question.
Thank you. Here in Austria, just taking the example of care homes, the situation is almost the other way around, in that most care homes are run by either they are public or they are not for profit, although there is a smaller percentage, I think it's about 20%, maybe even 25% are for profit. But it really is the smaller amount. And so there is much more of a sense of public infrastructure, public services that are directly owned and run rather than outsourced. And so there is a different relation there. And I think that certainly has shown also during the pandemic, and also that the infrastructure was better able to deal with the situation, even though there were also issues around protective equipment being available. And also here, there are staff shortages, and there are also issues around pay not being the same across the sector. And the ways also that, and this happens in the UK as well, where it's sort of social care, it sort of sits below healthcare in a way. The need for more people, for more staff and better working conditions. It's also a lot of people exhausted and burnt out. So it's not perfect. I think these countries are also grappling with a care crisis, but at the same time, I think the decision not to sell off, marketize, and financialize the infrastructure is makes a huge difference. In Germany, there has been quite a lot of debate about the ways in which this pertains more to healthcare, the ways in which hospitals have been privatized and have also tried to sort of reduce the number of beds in the name of cost efficiency and so forth. But for example, in Germany, what has just been decided is that there will be a better pay for care workers. So that's a kind of direct result, actually, of the pandemic, and a recognition that improvement needs to happen there. But I would say definitely with regard, even though the pressures are also here and some of the trends are similar, there has nevertheless been less privatization in this area, and that makes a difference. But also the family and the sort of gender issues are all there as well. Like I said, it's not perfect, but I think this issue particularly is very different.
Great. Does anybody have anything they'd like to add to the discussion? Dexter, you've got your hand raised. Dexter Whitfield. You need to unmute yourself. You just use the unmute function in the bottom left-hand corner.
It's been a great discussion, but I want to throw a spanner in the works in a way, in a positive sense. I would say that, I spent a lot of my early years where we were called upon by trade unions around Britain to stop the sale or the, and the closure of care homes in Britain. And we went, you know, I've been in many, many local authorities where we tried to, in a sense, stall or stop that process. In the vast majority of cases, we were unable to do that. But what we gained in that process was that we developed the ability, and it was very, very strong to identify what was, in a sense, a very positive, good care home that was locally managed, based in the community, had other public services related to it or based within it. And many of those homes weren't sold off and survived. But in a sense, that indicated a kind of model that one could start to form a basis for something. And I think my point related to that is that all the discussion around marketization, privatization, and financialization are three major processes which are ongoing and have been ongoing for several years, decades, and our ability to control those, despite what we might want to do and how we might control markets. I mean, the government doesn't even control markets, although it believes it can, and nor do local authorities control markets, but there's this process which is going on, which is eroding more and more, and our ability to control those processes is getting less and less and less. And related to that, we're also at the point where private, if you look at what's happening within the money that private equity funds are raising at the present time, partly in the secondary markets, but also in the primary markets, to buy more and more hospitals, care homes, and other parts of the public infrastructure, which are being, in a sense, privatized through that process. And at the same time, part of the resources which they are getting is from, yes, investment trusts, asset management funds, but also from our pension funds, which are being ploughed into these very processes we're trying to stall and stop in various kinds of ways. And it makes me just want to say that I think what we have to do is, rather than trying to fight financialization things, yes, we have to oppose it in all every way we can, but I think what we also have to do is, in a sense, reinvent what we mean by adult care. And what do we mean by care homes? And what we need is a multiplicity of different kinds of facilities for people of different ages and different abilities and whatever. And I think that, you know, it's not about harking back to what was in the 1960s and 70s or 80s, but there were models around which we can draw on from that period, but to redesign things in a way which are positive. I mean, what's happening in Barnet, for example, at the moment, where, you know, care homes were sold off 21 years ago. Some of those care homes have now come back to the council, although they haven't come back directly to the council, they've gone into the council's arm's length company. And also, Barnet Council has got various projects around, they've now just built a block of flats for people with dementia and so on. So individual channels are being developed. But what we need to do is to bring all these things together and think more positively and more collectively about care in the wider sense, and to confront marketization, privatization, etc. But I think the forces are so great at the present time that the best strategy is to actually develop alternatives to the whole care model. I'll stop there because I could go on forever now.
Thank you for that really useful, powerful, and important intervention, Dexter. I'm sure Emma and Amy will only agree with you, but if you have anything else you'd like to add, I'd also like to give Bev an opportunity to come back to us with any reflections that she may have had on the discussion. I'm very curious actually to hear a lot more from other people in this audience, I mean, who have worked on other models in other states. I mean, especially, I'm really interested in Kendra's work in China and what, you know, what is happening in the Chinese case, not in relation to labor, but in relation to the provision of, not just in relation to labor, but the labor of care, but in relation to the provision of care. And one would think that, yes, in this kind of very big state-driven society, they have something sorted out, but is that the case? So yeah, I don't know if you're still with us, Kendra, but it would be great to have some of your reflections as well, especially in the end on this discussion. And anybody else who wants to say anything right at the end, please do raise your hands again. So for now, I hand over to Bev first, I think, if she wants to say anything right now.
Just, I think this is great because I know there are a lot of people, clearly by the comments that are coming through, people really know what they're talking about. And it's so good. And I'd just like to hear a lot more. I'd like to see another session actually on this that develops some of the issues that have been raised. Because Dexter, it was only when you mentioned pensions, I suddenly went, oh my God, that's one of the biggest areas of investment. And if we think about pensions as workers' capital, because really it's just our deferred wages, plus, you know, what we don't get being used to privatise and financialise, I think that's really significant. So I'd love to hear more on that. Obviously, platforms, crucial infrastructure, again, pulling down wages. When I first started looking at care.com, it was just nannies and elderly care. Now it has dogs. So it's like, you know, what is this marketplace that we are entering and what we're calling care? So there's a lot of issues coming up. Private contractors, I'd like to hear more on private contractors because they're still out there. And I was talking to a woman at Lancaster Council who used to have to assess the regulations of 360 different private providers of care. So when we're talking about economies of scale, surely something could happen there. But, you know, what does it mean? So I think for me, it's just fascinating. And oh my goodness, Peter Lloyd, the comment on care courses, I studied those in the 1980s as the Thatcher government's attempt to get working class women to provide free labour. And it's just happening again. But when I go into the local college, the conditions are so much worse. I couldn't believe they could get worse, but they are actually worse. So I'd love to see a session that focused on the kind of labour aspects, the implications, really. We know it's horrific, but exactly how is this playing out and for whom? And of course, migrant workers, what happened after Brexit? I'm sure there's people out there who could tell us loads more on that. So I just think it's been great. So thank you very much. And it would be great to carry the conversation on.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Bev. Yeah, couldn't agree more. Emma, Amy, would you like to add anything at this point? Amy, since you're really the person who is behind this whole event, it would be great for you to have the last word.
I'll be very brief with them. I really appreciated everyone's insightful comments.
You need to speak a bit more loudly. Sorry, Amy, we can hardly hear you.
Sorry. Okay, I was just saying thank you everyone so much for your insightful questions and comments. I would also really appreciate continuing the discussion with some colleagues who've been kind of mooting the idea of an international workshop on care financialization next year. So if that comes to pass, I will advertise it, so please look out for it. And I think otherwise there's plenty more we can discuss within the LSE care themes. So thank you all so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy, for really getting us all together and to Emma. Bev, and to all the wonderful people who are here, who've had so many interesting reflections, and really we could go on for at least another hour and a half, and I think it would only get more and more interesting. So, but we must close now, and it's been a real pleasure to be with you, and thank you. Thank you all for coming together to discuss these issues. We will get back together again. Okay. Take care, everybody.